Hello, and welcome back to the Offspring Magazine, the podcast. It's Bea, and I will be hosting today's podcast. Today, I will be talking to Professor Johannes Krause, who is the director at the MPI for Evolutionary Anthropology in the Department of Archaeogenetics. Johannes and his team use genetics and biological tools to study our past. So in today's episode, we talk about human evolution, starting from Homo erectus all the way to Homo sapiens. We talk in detail about some of our closest ancestors, the Neanderthal, which I'm sure the majority of you will have heard of, and the Denisovans. And for those of you who have never heard of the Denisovans are also human species that have diverged from the Neanderthal. And actually, many of us contain Denisovan DNA. And another fun fact here is that Professor Krause was actually the person who discovered the Denisovans together with his team. In 2010, Krause and his co-workers, they successfully were able to reconstruct the mitochondrial DNA of a Denisovan individual from 30 milligrams of powdered material, which comes from the fingertip of one of the Denisovan bones. How crazy is that? So yeah, we talk in detail about how the Denisovans were discovered, who they are, what we know today, and how this discovery has contributed to our understanding of the past. I find the field of archaeogenetics absolutely fascinating, and I really hope you will too. So with that, please enjoy my conversation with Johannes Krause. Professor Krause, thank you so much for joining us today. Just start by introducing yourself and telling us what you research.
Yeah, so my name is Johannes Krause. I'm the head of the Department of Archaeogenetics at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, and I'm working on ancient DNA or archaeogenetics, so DNA from the past that links basically past populations with each other or populations from the past to present populations to learn something about the evolution or the genetic history of humans, as well as their commensal species, such as domestic animals or even microbes, so viruses or bacterial pathogens that are present in them, and we reconstruct them through time.
Okay, very interesting. So let's just start by talking about human evolution. Let's start by giving everyone a broad overview of human evolution, starting from Homo erectus all the way to Homo sapiens.
So humans evolved in Africa, so the fossil record is very clear. So this is not genetic data, but the oldest fossils that we have of hominins, so on the human lineage, are found in Africa. And our genus, Homo, starts also in Africa. So the oldest, basically, specimens on our genus, Homo, are found in Africa. And then from about 1.8 million years ago, we have Homo outside Africa, and that is Homo erectus. So Homo erectus was discovered, for example, in places like a site called Demanisi, which is modern-day Georgia and the Caucasus. And then there's also pretty old fossils found on Java, for example, in Southeast Asia, which are also thought to be Homo erectus. And we have similar age specimens, slightly older, but it's debatable, from Africa. They're called Homo ergaster, but it's also Homo erectus. So some people, it's always a bit hard to kind of define species based on bones. And some people say that it's the same species, Homo ergaster and Homo erectus. Some people say it's the African variant and kind of the Eurasian variant. But I think most people would agree it's all Homo erectus. It's the same thing that kind of starts from about 1.9, 1.8 million years ago, first appearing in East Africa. Then we have it outside Africa, so in Eurasia.
These Homo erectus, they could, you know, they were two-legged species that could walk upright, correct?
Exactly. So the name Homo erectus comes from erect, kind of they are basically upright walking. But you have basically hominins already from about 6 or 7 million years ago that could walk on two legs. So bipedal locomotion is probably like 6-7 million years old. But if you would have met such an early hominin like Australopithecus, famous Lucy, for example, that lived about 3 million years ago, you would have probably thought more of an ape, like a chimpanzee or a gorilla, than a human, because they were still doing a little bit of knuckle walking, or kind of not quite knuckle walking like chimps and gorillas do today, but they were not fully upright walking the whole time. Whereas Homo erectus, if you would see them, you would clearly think about a human, because they're really there. Their whole appearance is very much like the appearance of humans today, and it's really kind of erect walking. There's quite some debate why this transition happened from this more ape-like hominin to this kind of more human-like hominin, if you want. One hypothesis I like a lot is that it has something to do with endurance running, because some people are not aware of that, but humans are amazing in endurance running compared to any other mammal. We're the world champion in endurance running. Like, no other mammal can run basically like for, you know, 50 kilometers or something like that without basically stopping, breathing, kind of ventilating, because we have this kind of sweat glands that just allow us to get a lot of kind of rid of heat very fast, which animals, they often have fur, they don't have that kind of amount of sweat glands like we have. And also our whole body, our erect body, is perfect balanced for endurance running. So we're really not basically spending so much more energy when we're running 40 kilometers than when we're walking 40 kilometers, which is quite incredible if you think about it. So animals, for them, it works quite differently. So they spend a lot of energy while they are running. They spend less energy walking because they're four-legged mostly compared to humans that are two-legged. So two-legged is actually bad, but it's good for endurance running. So some people think this is what we're really good at. That's how we evolved. Humans evolved as an endurance runner. And why do we do that? It's thought that we evolved as an endurance runner to kind of be successful in hunting, because we're really not well equipped for hunting. We don't have big teeth, we don't have claws. So if you look into other mammals, we totally suck as a predator. But we need to be a predator because we need to have access to proteins, to high-rich food, to kind of protein-rich food, high-energy food, because we have a brain, and Homo erectus already had that large brain, that uses a lot of energy. So in our brain, Homo sapiens brain, about 20% of our whole metabolism, all energy, is actually consumed by our brain, but it's only 2% of our body weight. So it's really incredible. It's a very expensive tissue. So we have to feed that with energy. And we can only do that if we have access to animal food. And therefore, we have to become a predator. We could also be, in some people kind of have discussed that, a scavenger and eat dead animals, or just steal them away from some kind of successful predator like a cheetah or something like that. So there's much debate, many things we do not know. But a lot of people think endurance running allowed us to do something which is actually quite remarkable, and people still do today in Africa, which is hunting by just following basically an animal for a very long time until the animal collapses. So it's a strategy that basically allows you to, even as a human, hunt an antelope, even though the antelope is much faster. But if you kind of follow it, you track it, you always kind of like steer it up again, at some point the antelope overheats. So if it's running like for 10 kilometers or 5 kilometers or something like that, at some point it overheats, it actually collapses, and then you can just take a stone basically and kill it, and you just have to like carry it back in your camp or something like that. So that's a strategy that people still use in Africa, some hunter-gatherer tribes, and that's probably something that we were quite good at in the past, and that allowed us to then have access to animal proteins, which then allowed our brain to grow. And this is basically then always kind of the question of the hen or the egg: what first happened? Do we first kind of evolve the big brain, or first the kind of like erect body type? It happens about the same time that we become erect, bipedal, fully bipedal, like really strongly bipedal, as well as having this big brain that of course makes us smarter. And then we're also starting to use tools. There's some evidence for tools before, but like with Homo erectus, we really see complex tools. So then we have also the ability to use spears, for example, to maybe then kill an animal from the distance, or kind of to protect us, because animals, of course, they're large, they're massive, they have horns, they have teeth, they have claws. So this all then comes with Homo erectus. So Homo erectus is actually, out of all the, I mean, there's many definitions how many different types of humans existed, hominins, over the last 6 million years. But say there's like 20 different types or species or whatever you want to call them. Homo erectus is probably the most successful one, because they start around 1.8 million years ago and they disappear probably 200, 300,000 years ago, evolving into humans, Neanderthals, and other forms of hominins. But they're really around for almost 2 million years, like super successful. They're the first ones that come out of Africa. They settle Europe. They settle Asia. They come to, you know, kind of different ecozones. So they move into the tropics, into the kind of more mountains, into the more steppe-like areas. So they're really, really successful. And they're found everywhere in Europe, Asia, and Africa, then kind of starting from about 1.8 to 1 million years ago. And they evolve into different types of humans, as I just mentioned. So we have not quite figured out how exactly that happens or where that happens, but we think it happens in Africa, that a lineage basically splits off from this African Homo erectus, which is also called Homo ergaster, and that is basically moving out of Africa probably some 600,000 years ago and splits into two lineages. One lineage is becoming Neanderthals in Europe, and the other one is becoming what we call Denisovans. So this new hominin that we discovered about 10 years ago in the lab, not in a cave, in fact, the bone comes from a cave, but we didn't know it existed, but only from genetic sequencing, we now know that it exists, and we actually find evidence for it now in a lot of places in Asia. So this other lineage, Denisovan, is the sister lineage of Neanderthals, and they separate from each other about 400 to 500,000 years ago. So one is becoming Neanderthals in Europe, the other one is becoming Denisovans in Asia, and they replace Homo erectus that was present in Eurasia before, that came there 1.8 million years ago. And then they evolve into fully Neanderthals, fully Denisovans over the next 300,000 years or so, until about 50,000 years ago, finally modern humans come out of Africa, so Homo sapiens. We are extremely successful as well. We have evolved in Africa. We have probably evolved quite rapidly. At least there's some kind of suggestions that maybe it starts about 250,000 years ago. Then there's a bit of a dispersal within Africa, and then about 50,000 years ago, we managed finally to leave Africa. One should say there have been some earlier attempts of humans leaving Africa, modern humans leaving Africa. So there's some fossils, for example, from the Near East, from modern day Israel, that are about 100,000 years ago, but they never made it kind of further out than kind of just into Western Asia. And we really only 50,000 years ago finally managed to then disperse into Eurasia quite quickly, also into Australia. So about 45,000 years ago, modern humans are basically all over Eurasia and have then also stepped for the first time onto Australia. So there hasn't been any other hominins present in Australia, at least that we know of. And then from about 45,000 years ago, you have only modern humans in Australia. And then we have basically modern humans everywhere. And then about 25,000 years ago, we step kind of basically onto Alaska and kind of the northern tip of North America. And then from 15,000 years ago, when the glaciers melt, we then also move into North and South America. So in the kind of full continent, very rapidly again. And then the last large migration that happens in human history is the settlement of the Pacific. So all the tiny little islands, the beautiful places that we think about, Tahiti, Hawaii, Rapa Nui, Aotearoa, so New Zealand, like all those places get then settled in the last 3,500 years ago. Again, very rapidly, people move all the way from Taiwan into kind of the eastern Polynesia and Madagascar, in fact. So 9,000 kilometers on little boats, rafts, basically, and settling the rest of the world. And then modern humans are everywhere. But when modern humans leave Africa, they also then, of course, kind of somehow bump into Neanderthals and into Denisovans. And that's kind of part of where it became very interesting for us geneticists, because we had genetic data now of Neanderthals and Denisovans, and then we could study the interactions between modern humans and those extinct and archaic hominins.
Right. Wow. Thank you so much for this great timeline, very in-depth, but it definitely helps a lot. I have a lot of questions now. First of all, it seems like evolution is not necessarily so linear, but it seems like the Denisovans, Neanderthal, and Homo sapiens all evolved from Homo erectus, correct? So that was kind of like a linear evolution. Then, you know, you get these.
Yeah, one could say it's a linear evolution, but even during the time when Homo erectus existed, there were probably another three, four other forms of humans that existed that might have even been very, very deep divergences that were still around. Homo habilis, which is the ancestor of Homo erectus, was probably still around for some time. There's also something called Paranthropus, which is like a more kind of robust form, a vegetarian, in fact, hominin species that was probably still around until a million years ago or so. In South Africa, people discovered a few years ago Homo naledi, which is totally weird hominin that is quite small, has a small brain, looks some traits quite derived, some traits quite ancestral. Then on Flores in Southeast Asia, so in Indonesia on this island, there's another type of hominin that lived in Southeast Asia on an island called Flores that lived there until about 70,000 years ago that is called Homo floresiensis, which is a type of dwarf human that had a very small brain, only the size of a chimpanzee, small people, about 1 meter tall. They were discovered in 2003 when Lord of the Rings was in the cinema. So they're sometimes called hobbits. So when you hear about hobbits as archaic humans, then people talk about Homo floresiensis, really enigmatic dwarf form of humans. They also basically existed when Homo erectus existed probably a million years ago. They already stepped foot for the first time on that island. So there have been probably four or five different types of humans present even before Neanderthals in parallel. And really human evolution, as you said, it's not a lineage, it's more like a bush, right? So you have all kind of branches. And even, you know, when modern humans leave Africa, there's Neanderthals in Europe, there's Denisovans in Asia, there is Homo floresiensis on Flores, there's Homo luzonensis in the Philippines. There might be some other three different types of hominins in Asia. So there's a whole variety of different types of humans when modern humans come out of Africa. But then 5,000 years later, they're all gone. So basically, we really colonized the world quite fast, but we also replaced all hominins within very short time, leaving only one human left about 40,000 years ago, which is the modern humans.
Because if we look at Homo sapiens living right now, it seems like the genetic variation that exists is much smaller than, you know, like you said, 100,000 years ago or even...
Yes, certainly we have all those different lineages that are largely extinct now. I mean, due to the fact that we have genetic admixture between Neanderthals, Denisovans, and modern humans, some of that genetic material is sprinkled into, say, Europeans and Asians. So some archaic lineages have survived in us. So some of that diversity is present. Even though one should say that the genetic diversity of Denisovans and Neanderthals was much smaller than the genetic diversity that you have of modern humans, because modern humans coming out of Africa is a huge continent, has a lot of genetic diversity today and had much more genetic diversity than those other groups, just because those other groups had been in smaller regions like Europe during the Ice Age, which was very small. I mean, it's not kind of same size that it has now. It largely was covered with ice and not habitable, but that really caused a very small population, and the same was true for parts of Asia. But then, of course, if you take those three lineages together, Neanderthals, Denisovans, modern humans, there was more genetic diversity. But Africa in itself has just much, much more genetic diversity than even humans outside Africa today, because that's where we evolved. Only one part of that genetic diversity has left Africa, and largely much of that genetic diversity remained there and is still present in Africa today.
Yeah, we don't understand, though, why Homo sapiens kind of won the battle, correct? Or do you have a good hypothesis for why?
Yeah, I mean, I would be careful with battle. It sounds like too much like warfare or something like that. We don't even know if they ever kind of really had, you know, some sort of quarrel with each other, or if it was largely just an expansion of the human population. So modern humans having some sort of technology or some sort of advantage over those other groups, and they just expanded, and they, you know, they might have met, and certainly they had children with each other because we find genetic admixture between them. But it's not that they killed each other or something like that. That's something we do not know. But why?
I more meant like a biological battle. Like, yeah. What is it that was different, maybe in their DNA or their brain structure, that allowed them to be more successful?
That's, of course, one of the biggest questions. Actually, the founding concept of our institute here in Leipzig: what makes humans human? So what do we have with the other hominins and also close relatives like apes or chimpanzees or gorillas don't have? And we haven't really figured that out completely. There's a lot of hypotheses and a lot of ideas about that. On the one hand, we have more genetic diversity, which is always helpful. So in biology, if you have an organism that has more genetic diversity, it usually helps, especially if you have changes in the environment. And we're talking about the Ice Age, where there's massive changes in the environment all the time. There are droughts, there's a cooling period, a warming period. So this is certainly not climatic stability like we have today for the last 10,000 years. But this is a time when the climate fluctuated a lot, when humans basically started to migrate into the world. Humans are very smart. There's no question. We're the smartest species that probably ever existed on Earth, as far as we can say. We are also extremely good in adapting to different environments. So today we live in the Arctic, we live in the high altitudes, we live in the desert, we live in the tropic rainforest, we live on all kinds of plains. We have even learned to produce food and not just gather food. So we can, you know, we have domestic animals and plants. This is, of course, not what happened 50,000 years ago, but it happened in parallel on all continents after people had dispersed on all continents. So the knowledge, basically the ability to develop agriculture, like not the knowledge, but really the intelligence to do it or some sort of biological basis was basically present on all continents. So it's part of our nature. It's part of our basically biology. So we're really, really, really smart. And it could well be that this is just what the other species did not have. We have complex language. Neanderthals probably had also language, but was it as complex as we have? We do not know that for sure. So I think there have been quite a few basically biological adaptations that happened through time that allowed us to be that smart, basically hominin that we are. What is very powerful is the genetic data that basically Svante, my PhD supervisor and colleague here at the Institute, who recently also got the Nobel Prize for this amazing research that he did, that he basically sequenced the genomes of those archaic humans. I was part of that during my postdoc and PhD. Because we now have the genomes, so the whole genetic information from those extinct humans, Neanderthals and Denisovans, we could compare them to modern humans, we now have a catalog of all the genetic changes that happened after Neanderthals and humans, so modern humans, went separate ways. Basically, what happened on our lineage? What is special about us? We have basically all those positions in the genome that we have and the other archaic humans don't. So on the molecular level, we know actually pretty well, exactly, base by base, what is kind of unique to us. We now just have to understand what those genes exactly do and how they make us smarter, how they make us more successful, how they made us to this very unique and incredibly successful hominin that basically conquered the entire world and basically changed the planet to a point where we're now calling it the Anthropocene, so the age of humans. Within 50,000 years, we have basically changed the entire planet in a way that in millions of years, people would still, whoever, would still be able to recognize that happened. So it's really, there is something special about us. But what it exactly is, we still don't know. I mean, this is something that we now have this catalog, now bit by bit, position by position, gene by gene. We and other colleagues are now trying to understand exactly what those changes kind of caused, how they made us different, and what's the exact biology behind our great success. And there's many examples where we have already some ideas, like FOXP2, like a language gene that is slightly different in us than in Neanderthals. There's other genes that are involved in, for example, that my colleague Svante worked on, are involved in mitosis and kind of seem to be somehow different between Neanderthals and modern humans. So very basic level biology, like cell divisions, where there are already differences between Neanderthals and modern humans. So I think there can be many, many steps. And I think we need to do much more research to understand that. But the amazing thing now is we have basically that catalog. So we know exactly what positions are different and what makes us, you know, human. So how are humans kind of special? So what makes humans humans? On the molecular level, we now know, but we need to understand that better on the, what we call the functional level. So what exactly those genes do and how they interact. But given that we have so much human data now from modern humans from all over the world, from millions of people, genetic data, genomic data, phenotypic data, gene expression, like we have so much data, humans have become in biology now basically a model organism. So it's not, most people that have been working with Drosophila in the past have now moved to humans and human genetics and kind of human as a kind of model organism, because we have so much data from humans, because of course the medical field provides that to us. And that's quite powerful. So I'm very positive that over the next 10 years, we will learn a lot about what makes us so special, because we have that genetic diversity still present. So the Neanderthal genes are still out there. So if you compare people with Neanderthal genes with people that don't have those Neanderthal genes, you actually find out how are those groups different? And it will be very interesting to see those differences.
Right. That's actually really, really interesting. I didn't know that, because I would have always thought maybe we should be looking at the brain structure. But, you know, on a molecular level, it's also, it can tell you a lot. But to the brain structure, we know that the size of the brain was the same between the Neanderthal and Homo sapiens, right? Roughly the same. But we know that Homo sapiens were a lot smarter, as you just said. So it can't just be due to the brain size. It must also be due to the brain structure. Do we also have some kind of evidence or information to tell us what exactly about our brain structure makes us so smart?
Yeah, so this is really hard, because even for modern people, just based on size variation or structural variation, just looking at the kind of shape, at the morphology of a brain, you could not predict what the IQ of a person is. You know, I mean, there's always this urban myth that like Albert Einstein had a bigger brain than the average person. In fact, he had a slightly lower kind of brain size than the average person. So really, size, you know, it's not everything. And
well, it almost seems to be nothing, because it doesn't tell it. Like, I don't think if we drew a map of a correlation between size and intelligence since Homo erectus, we wouldn't really see a correlation, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, probably there is one if you go really back to hominins, because I think, you know, it's fair to say that Homo sapiens was more intelligent than Homo habilis or something like that, in terms of at least the tool kind of production. If you kind of measure archaeological complexity, as one way to kind of measure intelligence, not sure if that works, but I mean, one could attempt it, then certainly it gets more complex with more brain size. But within modern humans today, where we can do intelligence tests, which are highly problematic by itself, because, you know, they just measure what the test is designed for. If that's intelligence, you know, it's questionable. I mean, if you can kind of do complex mathematical equations, might not be helpful in the rainforest of Papua New Guinea, but like distinguishing between a snake and a leaf, I think is very, very useful. So that's still part of intelligence, but it's not what our intelligence tests measure. So it's also a bit of a question, what is intelligence in the first place? But indeed, we don't really think that size matters from kind of the knowledge that we currently have. If people have microcephaly, for example, where they have extremely small brains, then indeed they have a lower intelligence. So it is, you know, somehow it matters, but not, you know, kind of normal people, average people, it doesn't really seem to have a strong effect. And Neanderthals, in fact, had a bigger brain than modern humans have. So they are not around anymore. So then the structure itself, I mean, there's much kind of research on that, and it's nothing that we can really as geneticists contribute to. And we are really, like, on the molecular level, just trying to kind of to understand kind of the little kind of biochemical changes that then lead to maybe differences in metabolism or differences in cell division, or kind of on the very, very small level, before we get to a stage where we can talk about structural differences and how those changes influence structural differences. I think we are a bit far away from that, and we might get there eventually when you have some sort of kind of cell organoids, for example, which some of my colleagues are working on, where you then go from like a molecular level to kind of some organ structure level, where basically you have kind of complex cell culture, where at some point the cell culture becomes a tissue, so it really forms like a mini brain, or it forms a mini heart or something like that. And then you can really start to see if maybe things that have Neanderthal genes look different to things that have modern human genes. And you really have the basically little kind of in the Petri dish kind of Neanderthal brain and the kind of Petri dish kind of modern human brain. And then you start to see maybe kind of more structural differences. But we are far away from that. I mean, this is kind of just starting that type of research. And maybe then again, over the next 10, 20 years, we might know more about that.
Right, yeah. Tell me about the Denisovans, because it was your discovery in 2010, correct?
Yeah, so I've been very lucky in a way with working on those fantastic projects. So the Neanderthal genome first, doing my PhD, and then doing my postdoc. I was actually focusing on early modern humans, so the first people that came out of Africa. And I got this bone, tiny little piece of bone from a cave in Siberia called Denisova Cave, that the colleagues there had found and thought it's a modern human, because next to it they found a bracelet. So they thought that cannot be archaic, that must be kind of very, very recent. Not that anyone now thinks that the bracelet is from that hominin. It's just mixed probably in. There's kind of lots of perturbation in the site. But anyway, I got that little bone, I extracted DNA from it, and got the first DNA sequence, like a mitochondrial DNA sequence. So this is just part of the genome. So there's the large genome, and then we have the mitochondria have their own little genome. And this was not modern human. That didn't look like any population in the world today. That also didn't look like Neanderthals, which we already had the sequence then. But it was something that was even more basal, some deeper lineage. First, I thought it's actually Homo erectus because it had a divergence time, a rough estimate we did then was like a million years or so from modern humans. It's really, really deeply diverged lineage. I even thought, you know, maybe it's a completely different lineage, just something completely new, because Homo erectus, as we said, started to diversify 2 million years ago, but this was a million years diverged from modern humans. So we thought maybe it's some sort of Asian hominin that's not around anymore, some sort of lineage that we don't really know so much about. So it was very exciting. And then we sequenced the genome, and the genome actually told us a bit of a different story. So when we had the whole genome information, we actually could see that it was closer related to Neanderthals than to modern humans. So it's kind of the Asian version of the Neanderthal. So as we said earlier, there was this kind of Homo erectus branch, if you want, that came out of Africa and then evolved into Neanderthals in Europe and Denisovans in Asia. So it's really the kind of Asian Neanderthal. We then figured out, and this gets now a little bit more complex, why the mitochondrial DNA looked so different. Recently, we also looked at the Y chromosome of Denisovans, which is also very different. So basically, you get different stories when you study the Y chromosome of a Denisovan, the mitochondrial DNA of a Denisovan, and the nuclear genome of the Denisovan. And the mitochondrial DNA, the nuclear DNA, and the Y chromosome DNA, they are compatible with a history of a hominin that diverged from humans more than 500,000 years ago, like you would expect for Neanderthals as well, because we said Neanderthals and modern humans diverged some 600,000 years ago. So, however, Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA and the Y chromosome of Neanderthal, that's actually what is weird, because they are more closely related to us. And that was really confusing. And it might be now also very confusing to you when I say that. Like, how can a mitochondrium be closer related to a human? And why can the Y chromosome be closer related to a human than they are to Denisovans, even though they are sister lineages, Denisovans and Neanderthals? And we think the only explanation for that we have is that there was gene flow between Africa and Europe some 200,000, 300,000 years ago. There's also archaeology that actually links it. There's morphology. So there's some specimens like Petralona from Europe and a Broken Hill from Africa that look like twins. And they're like 300,000 years old. So there was probably people moving between Africa and Europe. And the Y chromosome and the mitochondrial DNA, they basically admixed into the early Neanderthals. And that's why early Neanderthals are actually a little bit more modern human than Denisovans are. So there's a little bit, they're a little bit on the nuclear genome as well as the mitochondria and the Y chromosome. They're a bit more modern human. So it's still Neanderthals and Denisovans are sister lineage. They're closer related to each other compared to modern humans. But between modern humans and Neanderthals, there was gene flow at some point 300,000 years ago. So it's a bit complicated, like I said. But Denisovans are really fantastic because we now have an independent lineage, archaic lineage to the Neanderthals in comparison to modern humans. So we have now two genomes of two archaic humans, Denisovans now and Neanderthals, that we can now compare to modern humans. And then again, find, for example, what makes us so special. So everything where Neanderthals and Denisovans look the same, but modern humans are different, is what basically makes us unique. And then the other thing that was very exciting about Denisovans was, we had already found out in 2010 that human populations outside Africa, so Europeans, Asians, Australians, Native Americans, they carry about 2% Neanderthal DNA because Neanderthals and modern humans admixed with each other. We think 15,000 years ago, so when humans came out of Africa 50,000 years ago, they met Neanderthals, they had babies with them, and then they carried this Neanderthal mixture into the whole world, into Europe, Asia, Australia, Americas, because they had to go through this same bottleneck coming out of Africa when they met Neanderthals, where we also know Neanderthals were present in the Near East at that time. And for Denisovans, we asked the same question. Do people today in the world carry Denisovan DNA? And the answer was no for Europe. But in Asia, especially in Southeast Asia, some populations have Denisovan DNA, a few percent, up to a few percent. And the Aboriginal population of Australia and Papua New Guinea in the highlands, they have up to 5% Denisovan DNA. So on top of the 2% Neanderthal DNA. They even have 5% denisovan DNA. And there's some other research now even suggesting that there have been some populations in the Philippines that have up to 7% denisovan DNA. So denisovan DNA has even to a larger extent than survived basically after humans came out of Africa and kind of largely replaced those archaic humans in some pockets in some places in the world, which is very exciting because it still means then we have actually quite some of that. Some people estimate up to 90% of the genetic ancestry of denisovans still running around in the world today because it has admixed into people and people carry different, even though they have just 2% Neanderthal or 5% denisovan, they have different parts of the genomes of those archaic humans, which again is fantastic. So we don't have to study necessarily bones from the past to find the genes of those archaic humans. We can actually study modern people. And there's more and more data for modern people available. And that basically at the end allows us to puzzle back even the denisovan or Neanderthal genome just from living people. You don't even have to go back to ancient bones to do that, which of course is then nice because then you can kind of link the phenotype and the genotype and learn more about what makes us human, but also about the kind of physiology or biology of Neanderthals and denisovans by studying people that still are around today that you can talk to, that you can kind of do kind of medical tests, for example, with.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. You did say, though, that in Australia, the first hominin was discovered 45,000 years ago. So we have no evidence of a denisovan ever being in Australia. It's just their DNA that ended up in Australia.
Yes, which is in itself quite puzzling. There is this famous Wallace line. So there is basically some sort of separation between what's called Sunda land, which is modern-day Indonesia largely, and what's called Sahul, which is Papua New Guinea in Australia. During the Ice Age, so more than 10,000 years ago, Papua New Guinea was part of Australia, and Java, Borneo, and Sumatra were part of the Asian mainland. And you basically had those two big land masses. One was Australia and Papua New Guinea, and the other one was basically Southeast Asia, which modern-day Indonesia was all one big land mass. In between that is a few islands, and Wallace, when he was kind of exploring this region in the 19th century, figured out that the animals and the plants across from those islands is very different. So on one hand, you have marsupials in Australia, Papua New Guinea, and so forth, and different plants, or dragons, like Komodo dragons and things like that. On the other side, you have kind of Eurasian fauna and flora. And this is an interesting line that somehow not a lot of animals manage to cross, because that's why you have marsupials on the one side, not on the other side. And humans also seem to have not been able to cross that. But then you have Flores, this enigmatic human that I mentioned before, that's actually across the Wallace line. So they managed, and probably more than a million years ago. And there's also now evidence in some human populations there that I mentioned that have denisovan admixture, and they're all across the Wallace line. So they're on the other side. They have a lot of this denisovan DNA, which kind of some people, including myself, think is probably because denisovans have been present across the Wallace line. They have been present on those islands. And one group even found evidence now that in Papua New Guinea, there's admixture of a different denisovan lineage than on the mainland and on other islands, which suggests that maybe they were even on Papua New Guinea. But we haven't found any fossils. We haven't found any archaeology. So certainly they were on those islands, because we have Homo floresiensis, but we do not know for sure if they stepped foot on Papua New Guinea in Australia. I think that's just very indirect evidence currently. Certainly, there's no big fossil record. There's no big archaeology. I mean, that really only pops up 45,000 years ago, the moment modern humans step on it, and they're everywhere. They disperse over the whole island. So Lake Mungo, which is very famous finding, is like very, very south. It's more than 40,000 years old. And it's already modern humans. They're basically like not too far away from Tasmania. So it's like in North America and South America, humans, the moment they step on a big landmass, they're just everywhere.
We also don't have any evidence of any denisovans reaching the North America or the Americas, because that also, I mean, via the Bering Strait, technically, you know, you could have traveled between Asia and America, and that just seems so puzzling. I agree with you, because they were fairly smart and they knew how to build tools. So, I mean, I'm assuming also they knew how to build ships because of fishing. You know, they needed to build stable ships to go fishing. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the evidence for ships or some sort of more complex rafts is very, very weak. I mean, we have the first clear ships, like canoes, basically, that are about 7,000, 8,000 years old, but doesn't go much further back in time. So modern humans certainly must have had some sort of complex rafts, because otherwise they would have not crossed between all those islands and like coming to Australia, which was at the time when they went there, you had to basically cross the waters and you had to cross open water. And then there's also some place like the Bismarck Islands and kind of other places where people really went onto islands. They must have crossed the water. So about 40, 45,000 years ago. But for Neanderthals and kind of earlier forms, kind of hard. I mean, Homo floresiensis got to Flores maybe more than a million years ago. If there was a ship or if it was a raft or some trees, some logs they were just hanging on, it's not really clear. I mean, there were all kind of species that managed out to kind of come to places in Polynesia, like tiny islands somewhere. They rafted on some wood or something like that. That is also possible. So we don't really know that. The Americas itself is fascinating. I mean, to one degree, it wasn't easy. Even modern humans, it took them a very long time to come to North and South America, because only about 15,000 years ago, the big ice shield over the Rocky Mountains starts to kind of have little kind of passages, and also the kind of shelf ice, which was basically kind of off in the water, kind of British Columbia today, only then is probably passable where then kind of little boats or something like that could kind of go from bay to bay and then come to North America, because kind of not really clear how humans got to North America, modern humans, so if they kind of went along the sea or if they went through this kind of ice-free corridor east of the Rocky Mountains is quite debated today. But that's only like 15,000 years ago. Modern humans have been in Siberia 40,000 years ago. So they also took them 15,000 years to manage to come there. In Alaska, they were probably already more than 20,000 years ago, because you could indeed walk there because it was still connected to the ice. But then there was this big ice shield that you could not easily cross. And Alaska in itself and in general northern Eurasia was super cold at that time, right? I mean, it's cold today. If you think about Alaska, you think about, you know, a lot of ice. And we'll talk about the ice age, where it was like 15 degrees colder than it is today. So it was really what we call the mammoth steppe. Certainly was interesting because there were large herbivores like mammoth and woolly rhinos and bisons, kind of like horses and like all kind of animals in this large steppe. So that reached all the way from Europe to Alaska. But archaic humans such as Neanderthals, we have actually no evidence of their presence up there. They never went up there. In fact, places like the Neanderthal, so which is in Germany, in central Germany, where the Neanderthals were first discovered, is actually some of the most northern places in the world where Neanderthals were found. So also Neanderthals were further south, because there was the ice age, it was so cold. You couldn't go much further up because there were glaciers everywhere, and it just was really cold time. So why humans then managed to go up there just means that they had a technology like we have today, like, you know, Eskimos had when they kind of moved into Greenland. That just allowed them to live in places that are super cold. And people live in Yakutia today, where sometimes it's minus 70 degrees in the winter, and they manage. And Neanderthals were not. Whether this is part of our, we had better clothing or technology or some sort of smart knowledge that allowed us to live in those places, I think Neanderthals and Denisovans didn't have it. It was just too cold up there to cross the Bering Strait for those humans that were more or less just doing fine where they were, which was kind of more south, more subtropical today. But of course, at that time, it wasn't subtropical. It was more temperate climate, but it was during the ice age.
So how did it take us so long to discover the Denisovans? Because your discovery was in 2010, if I'm not mistaken, and it's taught us so much. But and I don't know, have we found any other bones from Denisovans, or are we still just at this pinky?
No, there's about 7 bones now from the Denisova cave that are Denisovans. There's some bone that the Svante Papers group analyzed, which is actually an amazing discovery, because it was found as a tiny little bone fragment that other colleagues identified to be human based on some technology where they look at the collagen, at the kind of proteins, basically the peptides that are still stuck in those ancient bones. So they could say it's humans, it's hominin, but it could be Neanderthal, modern humans, Denisovans, whatever. And then when they sequenced it, they figured out it's not a Neanderthal, it's not a Denisovan, it's actually an F1 hybrid. So the mother is a Neanderthal, the father is a Denisovan, which is like incredible. So we even have a hybrid between those two hominin species that was found in that cave. So there's 7 bones now, and there's probably more on the way. So there's quite some presence of hominins. There's also Neanderthals. Actually, the best Neanderthal genome we have is actually from the Nisswa cave. So it's a really rich cave. So it has provided us a lot of interesting information. It seems that it was first occupied by Neanderthals, then the Denisovans moved in, then the Neanderthals moved in, then modern humans moved in. So it's kind of like a place to be in the Ice Age, it seems. But it's also because it's a long-term excavation. It's kind of a deep cave. There's a lot of kind of like layers that you can analyze. Also well-preserved,
probably also.
Exactly, also. So that's quite exciting.
But why, you know, like what are the chances that we discover them? Like you said, then bones were found, but then you wouldn't think that they're from a different species. So, you know, that just makes it seem like it's so hard to discover new species like the Denisovans that you did.
So I guess, I mean, of course, the technology to study genomes from the past has only become available during that time. I mean, the Neanderthal genome was one of the first ancient human genomes, right? So in that year, I think there were like 3-4 genomes published from ancient humans, and that's really just started. So then if you would just look at the morphology of the pinky, you could just say it's a hominin. You couldn't even say if it's a modern human, Neanderthal, whatever it would be. You just say, okay, it's probably human. But you can't say more than that. So morphology, you need whole skeletons. And even if you have whole skeletons, there's been so much debate about how humans actually evolved. The out of Africa theory that I kind of explained at the beginning, how humans came out of Africa 50,000 years ago, is a given now for us. It's something like, of course, humans came out of Africa. There's so much evidence for that, archaeology, genetics, and morphology. But when we only had morphology and archaeology, like people were fighting. It was incredible. In the early 2000s, still there was this debate ongoing whether humans evolved in parallel on all continents, whether Neanderthals are our ancestors of the Europeans, whether Homo erectus is the ancestor of Chinese people, whether Homo ergaster is the ancestor of people in Africa, which is super racist in a way, because it would mean there are three different species of people. There are Africans, there are Europeans, there are Asian, there are three different species. It's like, that's just incredible racist. But that was still the ongoing debate that we had in the early 2000s. Only now with all this genetic evidence, we kind of now have a very, very strong kind of view on kind of, you know, humans evolving in Africa, coming out of Africa and replacing all those other Neanderthals or archaic humans. So I think that's part of the reason. It's also very fragmentary bones that are not informative. They don't tell you much. So that's part of the story. And then one should also say that East Asia has some fantastic fossils, especially in China. When you look at them, they're not Neanderthals, they're not Homo erectus. They have names like Homo mabaiensis, Homo daliensis. They're not really accessible to a lot of research. They're not really, you can't download the CT scan of that kind of skull and kind of study it. You can't put in any analysis. You can just look at it, kind of say what could be. And a lot of people in paleoanthropology now think that those are just Denisovans, and we just didn't really have a good name for them. And now that we know genetically there is this lineage, they all get lumped together by some people said, okay, those are there. That's probably the Denisovans. But we need to get the genetic data from those fossils, which we haven't managed yet. So I think as soon as we get the first genetic data from one of those kind of fossil skulls that then have a label, and then we say, okay, those are the Denisovans, then we have actually been staring at them for 100 years. We just didn't call them Denisovans, but now probably then we can if we get DNA from them, and they are there. And they are not Homo erectus. So this is also something that I think was partially a problem, because there's some collection from a site called Ngangdong on Borneo, which was supposed to be Homo erectus. And it's about 70,000 years old. So people always assumed that Homo erectus was still around when modern humans came out of Africa. So they didn't need a missing link. They didn't need Denisovans. They didn't need to be a Neanderthal-like lineage in Asia, because we have Homo erectus. They just survived there, and they got extinct or replaced in Africa and in Europe by Neanderthals, and in Africa by modern humans. And then they were still around there. But actually, Ngangdong has been redated now to 250,000, 300,000 years ago. And basically, there is nothing else that is Homo erectus at that time. So Homo erectus was already extinct 250,000, 300,000 years ago in Asia, as we now think. So this was all then Denisovans. Then you need the Denisovans, because you need to bridge in the archaeology the record between Homo erectus and modern humans. And that's where the Denisovans fit in now. And it's incredible that this discovery is not coming out of some skull that you kind of look at, but it's actually coming out of the lab and right. A sequencing machine. It has really enriched, and it's really a missing link that we now have, and we can now kind of better understand the evolution of humans in Eurasia and in general.
It seems like in archaeology, you have to have an even more open mind than a lot of other fields, because there's still so much that we don't know and new information keeps on coming in. And so then you have to change maybe a hypothesis or an idea that you had. Do you think that archaeology is more of a science or a philosophy?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm probably not archaeologist enough to really go deeply into such a philosophical debate. What archaeology does, it's a humanity subject, right? And it makes, however, use of a lot of science. So many archaeologists have become scientists, and scientists now becoming archaeologists. So I think this kind of archaeogenetics, the name of my department, already shows that this is a connection between, you know, maybe some more kind of philosophy, kind of like humanities type of research, and kind of science, natural sciences, as we do in genetics. And the reason is they need all information to get to kind of reconstruct the life history or kind of story or evolution of the population that they're interested in, the sites that they're trying to understand. And they readily make use of whatever kind of new technology comes out, be it ancient DNA, be it ancient proteins, radiocarbon dating and residue analysis and what have you. I mean, they're trying to incorporate everything to reconstruct kind of the history of a site, of a population, of a region, and therefore they have to basically kind of be able to speak both and be both. So that's also what I think and hope for my department and for my graduate students and postdocs, that they're becoming fluent in both fields and languages in a way that they understand archaeology as well as understand genetics, and that they're becoming true archaeogeneticists. But that basically really combines then the two disciplines and fields, and creates this basically hybrid science from the humanities and the natural sciences, which I think it needs to really understand the past, because it's basically a new, historians have their texts and ancient sources. Unfortunately, it's hard to find new ones, so it's basically all from the 19th century. It's not much that has been uncovers, not that we found the Library of Alexandria or something like that, with like lots of new insights into the past. But we are producing a lot of new data, new information, and that's very powerful. And it's like a new text. We have uncovered a molecular library that we are kind of understanding now, and we're basically, it's exponential growth over the last years. We started with 3 genomes, now we're at 7,000, like 10 years later, and it's kind of exponentially growing. So there will be much, much more data from past populations.
The problem is, you know, how much data is lost, especially because Homo sapiens, for example, even Neanderthal had fire. How many bones have been lost? And I think that's the real challenge of archaeology, is that in the end you're constructing stories, but you really don't have all the information there. But, you know, with new scientific techniques, then we'll discover more and more. If you have 2 more minutes, I would have one more question really quickly, which would be, what do you hope or predict will be the next big discovery in archaeology or archaeogenetics?
Yeah, so I think I talked a little bit about those enigmatic humans like Homo floresiensis, the little hobbit guys. They are fantastic. And I think, you know, getting DNA from them and trying to understand what they are will be kind of a new, interesting chapter of human history and evolution in Southeast Asia. I think we have to understand what's going on in Southeast Asia, because there's so much diversity in terms of archaeology, in terms of morphology, in terms of even the kind of admixture patterns. We have found evidence for 5 admixtures between Denisovans and human groups in Southeast Asia. So there was a lot of interaction between them on little islands, and that caused a lot of interesting genetic diversity that we're studying today, but also in the past. And kind of getting more is, I think, quite important. It will tell us yet another chapter. Then Africa is still largely terra incognita in terms of like past populations, a very complex genetic history, has a lot of genetic diversity, as we said, has all those kind of ancient lineages that were present and that mixed with each other, and that we have very little data from the past and we can hardly model from the modern data. So I think trying to understand Africa, I think, is also quite important, like where our lineage basically evolved. And then trying to understand this whole out of Africa process You know, I say it so lightly, humans came out of Africa 50,000 years ago because we have this divergence time. But in fact, there is a big gap between 70,000 years ago and 45,000 years ago. We don't know where humans are. We don't know. We know they split off from Africans, but then where are they? Are they still in Africa, in East Africa, in North Africa? Are they in Saudi Arabia and Israel? Like, where are they? We don't really know. So there's a lot of interesting questions. And I think we will hopefully uncover some of those stories and chapters in kind of human history over the next couple of years.
Yeah. Well, Professor Kauza, this has been absolutely fascinating. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Sure, you're welcome.
That's it. Thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to learn more about Professor Kauza and his research, you can check out his webpage on the MPI for Evolutionary Anthropology website. The link is in the description below. And if you like our podcasts, please make sure to follow us on our Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram page. Thanks again for listening. Bye. Offspring Magazine, the podcast, is brought to you by the Max Planck PhDNet Science Communication Group, known as the Offspring Magazine. The intro-outro music is composed by Srinathrankumar, and the pre-intro jingle is composed by Gustavo Carrizo. If you have any feedback, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to write us at offspring.podcasts@phdnet.mpg.de. Until next week, stay safe, stay healthy. Bye.